A father looks down at his newborn daughter. He gently calls her name, hoping she'll turn her head and look at him.
Katie.
The baby stares straight up. Her eyes don't move.
Look at this over here.
The father picks up a little toy that's attached to the bassinet and shakes it.
Can you see this?
Still, the baby's eyes don't move. The father feels a flash of anxiety. His heart beats rapidly. He calls to his wife.
Brenda! Brenda! I don't think Katie can hear. I think she's deaf.
The baby's mother reassures the worried father.
Oh, honey, I'm sure she's all right.
She picks the baby up, and the baby immediately responds, wiggling and cooing. But the father's worries persist.
My grandfather was deaf, you know. I could have passed those genes on to her. I've got a really bad feeling about this. If Katie's deaf and it's my fault, I'll never forgive myself.
Sweetheart, there's nothing to worry about. Look, if it'll make you feel better, we'll call the pediatrician first thing Monday morning. Come on, cheer up. We've got a beautiful new baby. Here, hold her while I fix the blanket.
Okay.
Hey.
The father is not reassured. He spends the weekend ruminating about the threat of deafness. He imagines the worst, no hearing, no development of language, his beautiful child cut off from the world, locked in soundless isolation. By Sunday night, he has sunk into despair. His wife leaves a message with the pediatrician's answering service, asking for a Monday morning appointment. She spends the weekend exercising, reading, and trying to calm her husband. On Monday, the pediatrician tests the baby's hearing. The results are reassuring, but the father's spirits remain low. Not until a week later, when the baby shows her first startle when a truck backfires on their street, does he begin to recover and enjoy his new daughter again.
These are two people with two different ways of looking at the world. When the father has a negative experience, an argument with his wife, or a tax audit, or even a frown from his boss, he imagines the worst. Divorce, bankruptcy in jail, losing his job. He gets depressed. He feels listless. His health suffers. His wife, on the other hand, sees bad events as temporary, surmountable challenges. She tends to deal with problems, put them behind her, and go on with her life. She's energetic, and her health is excellent. Optimists and pessimists. I've been studying them for the past 25 years. I'd like to share some of what I've learned with you.
Welcome to Learned Optimism with Dr. Martin Seligman. Dr. Seligman is UPS Foundation Professor of Social Science and Director of Training in Clinical Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He's also one of America's leading authorities on motivation. With Martin Seligman, you're going to explore the ways you interpret events and the effects these interpretations have on your life. Learned Optimism will introduce you to the techniques that have helped thousands of people undo lifelong habits of pessimism and depression. You'll discover the far-reaching benefits of flexible optimism and the effects it can have on your relationships, your work, and even your physical health. By guiding you through your own exploration of your mental habits and your internal dialogue, this program will give you the choice of looking at your setbacks in a new light. Here again is Dr. Martin Seligman.
Optimism and pessimism are habits of thinking. The defining characteristic of pessimists is that they tend to believe that bad events will last a long time, that the consequences of those events will undermine everything they do, that these events are their own fault. Optimists, who are confronted with the same hard knocks in this world, think about misfortune in just the opposite way. They see defeat as temporary, and they see its causes as limited, confined to this one case. And they don't blame themselves for their defeats. Instead, they'll say that circumstances, or bad luck, or other people brought it about. These two habits of thinking, which we'll call explanatory style in this program, have dramatic and far-reaching effects on our lives. Literally hundreds of studies show that pessimists give up more easily and get depressed more often than optimists. These experiments also demonstrate that optimists do much better in school, at work, and on the playing field than pessimists do. They tend to exceed the predictions of aptitude tests. When they run for political office, optimists are more likely to get elected than pessimists. Optimists age better, and they're usually in better health than pessimists. They may even live longer. What we're going to do here is to help you find out where you are on the optimism-pessimism scale and how you can change harmful, pessimistic tendencies. At the core of pessimism is the phenomenon of helplessness. Helplessness is the state of affairs in which nothing you choose to do affects what happens to you. For example, if I offer you $1,000 to rewind this tape and start from the beginning again, you'll probably choose to do so, and you'll undoubtedly succeed. But if I promise you $1,000 to contract the pupil of your eye, using only your willpower, you may choose to do it, but that won't make any difference. You're helpless to contract your pupil. The muscles you would employ to rewind the tape are under your voluntary control. The muscles that change your pupillary size are not. There are a lot of things in life that are beyond our control. Weather conditions, our shoe size, the day taxes are due. But there's also a vast unclaimed territory of actions over which we can take control, or we can relinquish that control to other people or to fate. These actions involve the way we lead our lives, how we deal with other people, how we earn our living, all the aspects of existence in which we normally have some degree of choice. At a university where I once taught, I knew a young woman named Elizabeth who was a student there. For 3 years, her advisor, a professor of English literature, had been extremely helpful, almost affectionate. His backing, along with her high grades, had won her a scholarship to study at Oxford in her junior year. When she got back from England, her main interest had shifted from Dickens, which was her advisor's specialty, to earlier British novelists, particularly Jane Austen. Jane Austen was the specialty of one of her advisor's colleagues. Although her own advisor tried to persuade her to do her senior paper on Dickens, when she opted for Jane Austen, he seemed to accept her decision without resentment and even agreed to continue as her co-advisor. 3 days before her oral examination, her original advisor sent a note to the examining committee accusing the young woman of plagiarism in her senior thesis. Her crime, he said, was failing to give credit to two scholarly sources for her statements about Jane Austen's adolescence, in effect, taking credit for those perceptions herself. Plagiarism is the gravest of academic sins, and the young woman's whole future, her fellowship to graduate school, and even graduation itself, was now threatened. When she looked at the passages the professor said she had failed to credit, she found that both of them had come from the same source, the professor himself. She'd gotten them during a casual conversation with him. He had spoken as if these were his own thoughts on the matter, and he never mentioned the published sources where he had gotten them. In other words, the young woman had been sandbagged by a mentor who was jealous of losing her. A lot of people would have been furious at this professor, but not Elizabeth. Her habit of pessimistic thinking took over. She was certain she would appear guilty to the committee. She told herself that there was simply no way she could prove otherwise. It would be her word against his, and he was a professor. So instead of defending herself, she collapsed inwardly. She looked at every aspect of the situation in the worst possible light. She told herself that it was all her own fault. It didn't really matter that the professor had gotten the ideas from someone else. The main thing was that she had stolen the ideas, since she had failed to credit the professor. She believed she had cheated. She began to think of herself as a lifelong cheat. This may seem incredible, but careful research shows that people with pessimistic habits of thinking can transform mere setbacks into disasters. One way they do this is by converting their own innocence into guilt. Elizabeth dredged up memories that seemed to confirm her verdict against herself. The time in seventh grade when she had copied test answers from another girl's paper. The time in England when she had failed to correct the misimpression of some English friends that she came from a wealthy family. And now, this act that she had convinced herself was cheating on her thesis. She stood in silence at her hearing before the examining committee and was denied her degree. This story does not have a happy ending. With the washout of her plans, her academic life was ruined. For the past 10 years, Elizabeth has worked as a sales girl. She has few aspirations. She no longer writes or even reads literature. She's still paying for what she considers her crime. But there was no crime, only a common human frailty, a pessimistic habit of thinking. If she had said to herself, "I was robbed, the jealous bastard set me up," she would have risen to her own defense and told her story. The professor's dismissal from an earlier teaching job for doing the same thing might have emerged. She would have graduated with high honors if only she had different habits of thinking about the bad events in her life. Our habits of thinking are not written in stone. We can change them. One of the most significant findings in psychology in the last 20 years is that people can choose the way they think. When I was a graduate student in psychology 25 years ago, dilemmas like Elizabeth's were not explained the way they are today. At that time, people were assumed to be products of their environment. The prevailing explanation of human action was that people were pushed by their internal drives or pulled by external events. The details of this pushing and pulling depended on the particular theory you happened to hold, but all of the fashionable theories agreed on this basic proposition. But starting around 1965, the favored explanation began to change radically. Environment was considered less and less important as a cause of behavior. Then in 1967, with the publication of Ulrich Neisser's Cognitive Psychology, a new field captured the imagination of the young experimental psychologists who were fleeing the dogmas of behaviorism. Cognitive psychology argued that the workings of the human mind could be measured and their consequences could be studied by using the information processing activities of the computer as a model. So the dominant theories in psychology shifted focus in the late 1960s from the power of the environment to individual expectation, preference, choice, decision, control, and helplessness. And in exploring these new theories, we've learned a lot about how people develop, how they learn, and how thoughts affect actions. We've learned that pessimistic habits of thinking arise from feelings of helplessness, that you have no control over what happens to you. And we've learned that optimistic thinking arises from just the opposite, from the notion that you do have control and you can change your life. And most importantly, we've learned that these habits of thinking are not ingrained. Helplessness and pessimism are learned, and optimism can also be learned.
When you opened this cassette package, you also found a card enclosed. Take a look at the card if you haven't already. There are 48 statements on the card, each one followed by two responses, A and B, to the statement. This is a test of your explanatory style. It's a test with no right or wrong answers. It's simply a way to get a view of yourself that you might not otherwise see. We'd like to ask you now to take this test, and then we'll explain how to interpret it. On average, this test takes about 15 minutes. If you don't have 15 minutes or you're not in a convenient place to take the test now, stop the tape and resume listening after you've been able to take the test. Each of the 48 statements on the card is a brief description of a situation. As you read these descriptions, try to vividly imagine each of them happening to you. You probably haven't experienced some of these situations, but that doesn't matter. Sometimes neither response will seem to fit, but go ahead and choose one of them, the one you think is likelier to apply to you. And try to be honest with yourself. Don't choose the response you think you should have to a situation. Choose the one you think you're most likely to have. Ignore the letter and number codes while you take the test. We'll explain what they mean shortly. So pause the tape and take the test. Now we're going to explore what your reactions to these 48 situations say about your explanatory style. The test is divided by the letter and number codes into distinct sections. Each section is designed to reveal a different facet of your explanatory style.
How do you think about the causes of the misfortunes, small and large, that befall you? Some people make statements like, "It's my fault. It's going to last forever. It's going to undermine everything I do." Others say, "It's just circumstances. It's going away quickly. And besides, there's much more to life." These habitual ways of explaining bad events are more than just the words you mouth when you fail. These are habits learned from childhood and adolescence. Your explanatory style comes directly from your view of your place in the world, whether you think you're valuable or deserving or worthless and hopeless. It's the hallmark of whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. There are three crucial dimensions to your explanatory style: permanence, pervasiveness, and personalization. Let's see what each of these mean.
Go through your responses now and note the ones marked PMB, capital P, lowercase m, capital B. This stands for permanent bad. People who give up easily, who have learned helplessness, believe the causes of bad events that happen to them are permanent. The bad events will persist and always be there to affect their lives. People who resist helplessness believe the causes of bad events are temporary. The items marked PMB tested how permanent you tend to think the causes of bad events are. The PMB questions are numbers 5, 13, 20, 21, 29, 33, 42, and 46. Each response with a 0 after it is optimistic. Each response with a 1 after it is pessimistic. For example, look at question 5. If your response was, "I'm not good at remembering birthdays," that's a more permanent and therefore pessimistic reaction to this situation. Total the numbers in the right-hand margin of the PMB questions. Then write your total on the PMB line in the scoring key at the end of the test. If your total was 0 or 1 for these 8 situations, you are very optimistic on this dimension. 2 or 3 is a moderately optimistic score. 4 is average. 5 or 6 is quite pessimistic. And 7 or 8 is extremely pessimistic.
Here's why the permanence dimension matters so much. Failure makes everyone, at least momentarily, helpless. It's like a punch in the stomach. It hurts, but the hurt goes away. And for some people, it goes away almost instantly. These are the people whose scores total 0 or 1. For others, the hurt lasts. It seethes. It roils. It congeals into a grudge. These people score 7 or 8. Even a small setback can leave them helpless for days or months. After a major defeat, they may never come back.
The next section of the test explores the optimistic side of explanatory style. Optimistic style is just the opposite of the pessimistic style of explaining events. People who believe good events have permanent causes are more optimistic than people who believe good things have temporary causes. Take a look at the situations marked PMG. That stands for permanent good. These are numbers 2, 10, 14, 15, 24, 26, 38, and 40. The responses with a 1 following them are the permanent optimistic answers. The 0 answers are pessimistic. Total the numbers on the right-hand side. Write the total on the line in the scoring key marked PMG. A score of 7 or 8 is very optimistic. 6 is moderately optimistic. 4 or 5 is average. 3 is moderately pessimistic, and 0, 1, or 2 is very pessimistic.
Remember, the optimistic style of explaining good events is just the opposite of the optimistic style of explaining bad events. People who believe good events have permanent causes try even harder after they succeed. People who see temporary reasons for good events may give up, even when they do succeed, because they believe the success was a fluke.
These first two dimensions, permanent good and permanent bad, were about time. The next dimension is about space. It's called pervasiveness. Some people can put their troubles neatly in a box and go about their lives, even when one important aspect of it, their work or their love life or whatever, is suffering. These people make specific explanations about adversity. Others find their troubles spilling over into every area of their lives. When one thread of their life snaps, the whole fabric unravels. These people make universal explanations about adversity. Now take a look at your responses to the situations marked PVB. That stands for pervasiveness bad. These are numbers 8, 16, 17, 18, 22, 32, 44, and 48. Add the numbers on the right and write the total on the PVB line in the scoring key. A total of 0 or 1 for these situations is very optimistic. 2 or 3 is a moderately optimistic score. 4 is average, 5 or 6 is moderately pessimistic, and 7 or 8 is very pessimistic.
Consider this example. In a large retailing firm, half of the accounting department gets fired. Nora and Kevin are two of the fired accountants. Understandably, they both become depressed over their firing. Neither one of them can stand to look for another job for several months. They both avoid doing their income tax or anything else that reminds them of accounting. During this time, though, Nora is still a loving and active wife. Her social life continues normally. She stays healthy. She gets plenty of exercise. But Kevin falls apart. He ignores his wife and baby. He broods. He won't go to parties. He doesn't laugh at jokes. He gets a cold that lasts all winter, and he gives up jogging. Some people can put their troubles neatly into a box and go about their lives, even when one important aspect, in this case their job, is suffering. Other people tend to bleed all over everything. They catastrophize. They mentally turn their troubles into total disasters. When one thread of their life snaps, the whole fabric unravels. It comes down to this. People who make universal or pervasive explanations of their failures give up on everything when a failure strikes in one area. People who make specific explanations may become helpless in that one part of their lives, but the others remain unaffected and intact.
Now let's take a look at the opposite side of the pervasiveness coin. People who use the optimistic explanatory style believe good events will enhance everything they do. They give good events pervasive explanations. Pessimists, on the other hand, give good events very specific causes. The pervasive good situations are numbers 6, 7, 28, 31, 34, 35, 37, and 43. Each answer followed by a 0 is pessimistic. The 1s are optimistic. Again, total your score and put the total on the PVG line in your scoring key. A score of 7 or 8 is very optimistic. 4 or 5 is average. 0, 1, or 2 is very pessimistic.
The next score may well be the most important single score from this test. It's a measure of hope. For some time, hope has largely been the province of television preachers, of politicians, and of hucksters. But the concept of explanatory style brings hope into the laboratory, where scientists can dissect it in order to understand how it works. People who make permanent and universal explanations for their troubles, tend to collapse under pressure. That collapse is caused by hopelessness, and it's usually for a long time, and it usually affects their entire life.
Hope is measured on this test by combining two dimensions, pervasiveness and permanence. Finding temporary and specific causes for misfortune is a sign of hope. Seeing misfortune as permanent and universal leads to despair. Now add your PVB total from the scoring key to your PMB total. This is your hope score for bad events. If it's 0, 1, or 2, you're extraordinarily hopeful. If it's 3, 4, 5, or 6, you're moderately hopeful. 7 or 8 is average. 9, 10, or 11 reveals a moderate amount of hopelessness. 12 or more is severely hopeless.
Of the three dimensions of explanatory style, permanence, pervasiveness, and personalization, the last one, personalization, is probably the easiest to understand. After all, one of the first things a child learns to say is, "He did it, not me." Personalization is also the easiest dimension to overrate. It controls only how you feel about yourself. But pervasiveness and permanence, the more important dimensions, control what you do. As you add up your personalization scores, keep this in mind. When bad things happen, we can blame ourselves. We can internalize. Or we can blame circumstances or other people. We can externalize. To what extent do you blame yourself when bad things happen? People who blame themselves tend to have low self-esteem and a pessimistic outlook. People who blame circumstances or others don't lose self-esteem when adversity strikes. Usually, they like themselves better and they're more optimistic.
Now look at your PSB scores. These are numbers 3, 9, 19, 25, 30, 39, 41, and 47. Items followed by a 1 are pessimistic or internal. They indicate low self-esteem. A score of 0 or 1 for these situations indicates very high self-esteem. 2 or 3 indicates moderately high self-esteem. 4 is average. 5 or 6 indicates moderately low self-esteem, and 7 or 8 means very low self-esteem. Your last score is the PSG dimension. This stands for personalization good. The numbers to look for are 1, 4, 11, 12, 23, 27, 36, and 45. Items followed by a 0 are external, therefore optimistic. The ones are internal and pessimistic. 7 or 8 is a very optimistic score. 4 or 5 is average. 0, 1, or 2 is very pessimistic. Now let's compute your overall scores. First, add the three B's, PMB plus PVB plus PSB. This is your total bad event score. Next, add your three G scores, PMG plus PVG plus PSG. This is your total good event score. Finally, subtract your B total from your G total. This is your overall score. Here's what all this means. If your B score is from 3 to 6, you are marvelously optimistic. If it's in the 6 to 9 range, you're moderately optimistic. 10 or 11 is about average. 12 to 14 is moderately pessimistic. And 15 or more is extremely pessimistic. If your G score is 19 or above, you think about good events very optimistically. 17 to 19 indicates moderately optimistic thinking. 14 to 16 is about average. 11 to 13 is rather pessimistic. And 10 or less indicates extreme pessimism. Finally, your G minus B score, or your total for the test. 8 or more means you are very optimistic in all cases across the board. 6 to 8 means moderately optimistic. 3 to 5 is average. 1 or 2 is moderately pessimistic. And 0 or below is very pessimistic.
There's a brief caveat I want to insert here. You're going to see the extensive benefits of learned optimism. But there are also some dangers you should be aware of. Learning to think of bad events in your life as temporary and local is fine. That will enable you to bounce back quickly. But be careful with externalization. Blaming circumstances or other people for your troubles can erode personal responsibility, and that will work against you in the long run. It's important to strike a balance when it comes to externalization and internalization. The idea is not to avoid responsibility for your troubles. It's to keep your troubles from ruining your life. The key element is change. If you want to change, the most important dimension is not personalization, it's permanence. If you believe the cause of your problems is permanent, your own stupidity, lack of talent, ugliness, or whatever, then you won't act to change it. But if you believe the cause is temporary, you can act to change it.
The goal of this program is not to make you a complete optimist. As you'll see, there are times when pessimism is actually appropriate, and there are times when an optimistic explanatory style is not the best way to think about a situation. Learned optimism is flexible optimism. The aim of this program is to increase your control over the way you think about adversity. When bad events strike, you don't have to look at them in their most permanent, pervasive, personal light. You don't have to become crippled by depression and pessimism. These techniques are designed to give you a choice about how to look at your misfortunes. Optimism is a tool to be applied when it's needed, not blindly in all situations. Let's spend a few moments now examining some specific examples of when to use optimism and when not to use optimism.
The first question to ask yourself is, do I need to change my explanatory style? Your score on the test will tell you that. If your score was less than 8, then the answer is yes. You would definitely benefit from a basic change in your explanatory style. But even if your score was above 8, there are 3 more questions you should ask yourself. Number 1, do I get discouraged easily? Number 2, do I get depressed more than I want to? Number 3, do I fail more than I think I should? Give these questions some thought and give yourself honest answers. If the answer to any of them is yes, then you can make good use of these learned optimism techniques. With an optimistic explanatory style, failures don't have to feel like failures. They become valuable learning experiences. Depressions won't last long, and they'll be far less frequent, and you'll have the means to overcome negative and discouraging feelings. But in a more specific sense, when should you use this tool of optimism? In what situations should you deploy the explanatory style-changing skills you're going to learn? Another question will provide a good test. Ask yourself what you're trying to accomplish. If you are in an achievement situation, getting a promotion, selling a product, writing a difficult report, trying to win a game, then use optimism. If you're concerned about how you'll feel, that is, if you're fighting off depression or trying to keep up your morale, use optimism. If you're in a situation that's going to take a long time to resolve and your physical health is an issue, then use optimism. If you want to inspire other people, if you want to lead, if you want people to vote for you, then by all means, use optimism. But there are times when these techniques are not appropriate. There are times when a more pessimistic explanatory style is more suitable. For example, if your goal is to plan for a risky and uncertain future, don't use an optimistic style. You're better off here, building in the kinds of contingencies that a pessimistic view will include. In other words, hope for the best, plan for the worst. If your goal is to counsel other people whose future is dim, don't start out using an optimistic explanatory style. Or if you want to appear sympathetic to other people's troubles, don't begin with optimism. For example, if your best friend has just lost her husband, it's not going to help her much if you try to replace her grieving with optimism. Later, once confidence and empathy are established and she's had a chance to grieve, then you can try optimism. The fundamental guideline for not employing optimism is to ask what the cost of failure is in a particular situation. If the cost of failure is exceptionally high, optimism is the wrong strategy. The pilot in the cockpit deciding whether to de-ice the plane one more time doesn't need to tell himself that it's probably okay. He needs to be pessimistic and de-ice the plane. The partygoer deciding whether to drive home after that fourth drink should not decide that she can handle it. She should take a pessimistic attitude and get a ride home. The frustrated spouse deciding whether or not to have an affair that could potentially break up the marriage is not a candidate for optimism. In each of these situations, the cost of failure is high. If the pilot doesn't de-ice the wings and they need it, the plane may crash. If the partygoer decides it's okay to drive home, she's risking a serious accident. If the spouse decides to have that affair, it could mean irreparable damage to the marriage. On the other hand, if the cost of failure is low, use optimism. The sales agent deciding whether to make one more call loses only his time if he fails. The shy person deciding whether to attempt to open a conversation risks nothing more than rejection. The teenager trying to figure out whether to take up a new sport risks only frustration. The disgruntled executive passed over for promotion risks only some refusals if he quietly puts out feelers for a new position. These are all prime candidates for optimism. Learning optimism is basically a matter of the ABCs. A is for adversity. When we encounter adversity, we react by thinking about it. Our thoughts rapidly congeal into beliefs. That's what the B stands for. These beliefs become so habitual that we don't even realize we have them unless we stop and focus on them. And these beliefs don't just sit idly in our brains. They have consequences. And that's the C in these ABCs. The beliefs are the direct causes of what we feel and what we do next. They can spell the difference between dejection and giving up on the one hand and feeling strong and healthy and taking constructive action on the other. Let me give you an example.
Katie has been on a strict diet for 2 weeks. One night after work, she goes out for drinks with some friends and eats some nachos and chicken wings that somebody had ordered for the group. Immediately afterwards, she feels she has ruined her diet.
Way to go, Katie. You sure blew your diet tonight. I'm so unbelievably weak. I can't even go into a bar with some friends without making a total glutton out of myself. Oh, they must think I'm such a fool. Well, my dieting over the last 2 weeks is blown forever, so now I might as well really make a pig out of myself and eat the cake in the freezer.
Katie breaks out the Sara Lee and eats a whole chocolate fudge brownie delight. Her diet, which she had followed scrupulously until tonight, begins to unravel.
Following the ABC model, here's what happened. Katie encountered some adversity. She ate some things that weren't on her diet. She reacted by thinking about what she had done and formed a set of beliefs about her actions. She decided she was weak, a glutton, and a fool in the eyes of her friends. And her beliefs had consequences. She gave up on her diet. But the connection between the nachos and chicken wings and Katie giving up her diet is not a necessary one. Katie doesn't have to think those thoughts, and she doesn't have to take those actions, and she doesn't have to suffer those consequences. She can set up a very different reaction if she starts by disputing her own automatic, pessimistic explanation. She could say something like this to herself.
Slow down, Katie. First of all, I did not make a total glutton out of myself at the bar. I drank 2 light beers and ate a couple of chicken wings and a couple of nachos. I didn't have dinner, so I think on balance I probably consumed only a few more calories than my diet allows. And letting my diet slip a bit for just one night does not mean I'm weak. Think how strong I am for sticking to it so strictly for 2 weeks. Furthermore, no one thinks I'm a fool. I doubt if anyone was keeping tabs on what I was eating. In fact, a couple of people mentioned I looked slimmer. And even if I did eat a couple of things I shouldn't have, that doesn't mean I should give up on my diet. That makes no sense. The best thing to do is to cut my losses, let myself off the hook for making a minor mistake, and continue dieting as strictly as I have been for the last week.
Now, Katie has interrupted the vicious circle created by her pessimistic belief. By challenging her initial interpretation, she changed the consequences of her actions. Instead of giving up, she made peace with herself and continued on toward her goal. Now I'm going to teach you how to do it. The first step, which you've just taken, is to see the connection between adversity, belief, and consequence. The second step is to see how these ABCs operate every day in your own life. These techniques are designed to change explanatory style from pessimistic to optimistic. In developing them, I work with two of the world's leading cognitive therapists, Dr. Steve Holland, professor of psychology at Vanderbilt and editor of the major journal in the field, and Dr. Arthur Freeman, professor of psychiatry at the New Jersey College of Medicine and Dentistry.
Now we have an assignment for you. To find out how these ABCs, adversity, beliefs, and consequences, operate in your daily life, keep an ABC diary for the next day or two. Just long enough to record 5 adverse situations and your reactions to them. Use a notebook or several sheets of paper, anything that you can keep easy track of, and note the adversity, the belief, and the consequences for 5 incidents.
The way you construct your ABC diary is to tune in on the perpetual dialogue that takes place in your mind. Then it's simply a matter of picking up the connection between an adverse occurrence, even a very minor one, and a feeling or action that results. Notice that there are 3 parts to the record you'll keep in your diary. The first section is adversity. This can be almost anything: a leaky faucet, a baby that won't stop crying, a large and unexpected bill, or a major confrontation with your spouse or a colleague. When you record your description of what happened, be objective about it. Don't evaluate it in this section. So if you had an argument with your spouse, you might write down that she was unhappy with something you said or did. But don't put down she was unfair under adversity. That's an inference, and that belongs in the second section, belief. Your beliefs are the way you interpret the adversity. In this section, be sure to separate your thoughts from your feelings. Feelings will go under the third section, which we'll get to in a moment. I just blew my diet, and I'm incompetent, are beliefs. Their accuracy can be evaluated. But if you say, I feel sad, that's a feeling. It doesn't make sense to check the accuracy of I feel sad. You either feel sad or you don't. The final section is consequences. Here you record your feelings and your actions. Did you feel sad, anxious, joyful, guilty? Often you'll feel more than one thing. Write down all the feelings and actions you're aware of that result from this incident. I had no energy. I made a plan to get her to apologize. I went back to bed. These are all consequent actions. Start your diary now. Stop when you've recorded 5 events, 5 ABC sequences from your life. Look for the link between your belief and the consequences. What you will see is that pessimistic explanations or beliefs set off passivity and dejection. Optimistic explanations result in constructive actions and increased energy. Becoming aware of this link between your beliefs and their consequences is the first step in changing your explanatory style. The next step follows immediately. If you change the habitual beliefs that follow adversity for you, your reaction to adversity will change in lockstep.